This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to the new fall season of Radio EcoShock 2015. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm in a funk. It's been toxic to go outside for 4 days. Here in the West, we are smoked in. Making a quick run outside, we get bits of falling ash in our eyes from the big fires in Washington State. We gave up and went back. Without my walks in nature, in all weather, I'm in a skunky mood, and the body gets stiff. At least I still have a house. A few dozen families nearby are not so lucky. We had 5 of them staying with us during the fire evacuation. The nearby city of Grand Forks just got an evacuation alert. It's not an order to get out, it's just a warning to get your photos and documents and pet supplies, a grab bag of clothing, keys, and money, and have it ready to go by the door. The so-called Stickpin Fire is just 4.5 kilometers, or about 2 miles, from the Canadian border and rural Grand Forks. You know, I try to do a global show with information that works for people in Scandinavia, Singapore, Australia, or California. Climate change is like that. But this program is unashamedly about the American West. Yes, that does matter to everyone. California is probably the world's 5th largest economy, and it provides food for not just America and Canada, but for the world. I won't try and tell my listeners in England that this hellish mix of drought and fire is coming to you anytime soon. In fact, it looks for another coolish, wet, miserable winter coming for the British Isles and Northern Europe. But the carbon and ash spiraling up into the sky in North America is just part of a worldwide pattern of deforestation due to climate change. It can happen in Australia, it can happen in many parts of the world. Trees are mostly carbon, and they are releasing their storehouse. It's an open question how many of them will grow back. Their ash will be sucked up into the Arctic, where the already gray ice will get darker still, licking up the sun, hastening the melting of glaciers. For me now, climate change is real and it's personal. My favorite grove of trees, ponderosa pines growing on a small island and a river, flanked by a verdant pool, burned to the ground a couple of weeks ago. All I have is a photograph. A lot is gone, and it's not over. The residents of Washington State are fleeing the largest fire that the state has ever seen. Later in this program, we'll hear a NASA scientist tell us about the coming 30-year or 40-year mega droughts. But first, I want to share the latest report on the strong link between climate change and the fires that are burning up the West Coast, from California through Canada all the way into Alaska. I'm going to play you a teleconference held August 26th, arranged by the group Climate Nexus. We'll hear 2 scientists and a veteran firefighter. Maybe I'm biased because I'm surrounded by mega fires right now, but I found this exchange riveting and full of insight for all of us. Thank you for coming back to Radio EcoShock. Let's roll with Climate Nexus host Paige Knappenberger, climate scientist Mark Cochran and Park Williams, plus retired fire captain Lou Paulson. Every day we wake up.
Everywhere, millions of acres of forest in Hello, and thank you for joining us today. This is Paige Knappenberger here at Climate Nexus. I'm the Media Relations Manager. Thank you for joining us today on this call about the climate connections to wildfires that are currently scorching the West. I'd also like to thank our three fantastic panelists for joining us today. In a few minutes, we will be hearing from our three speakers, Dr. Mark Cochrane, Dr. Park Williams, and Captain Lou Paulson. Each of our speakers will share some insights, and then we'll open the call for questions. First up, we'll hear from Dr. Mark Cochrane. Mark is a professor and senior research scientist at the Geospatial Science Center of Excellence at South Dakota State University.
Well, thank you. So as we know, this year is quite a lot of fire across the West. Currently, we got 66 large fires burning about 1.6 million acres scattered across California, Montana, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington, with Washington being high in that list of severe fires this year. But there's a question of whether or not this relates to climate and what exactly is going on. And it's complicated because part of it is based on what we've done in the past with fire suppression in many areas. Part of it's really based on, we think of these fires as bad because it's where we have people living and we keep moving into burning areas. But part of it does relate to changes in climate, and they're not changing so much the number of fires as the ability to control these fires. So many of these fires are getting larger every year and impacting more areas. And the way this is primarily working is that with climate change, we have rising temperatures. And when we look across the planet, but the West has large areas that are seeing very significant rises in temperature. This helps increase the fire danger together with relative humidity, drought in general, and wind speed. And the West in particular has kind of the worst combination going for it, in that we have significant rises in temperature, we have significant drops in relative humidity that dries out fuels. We have increases in the number of rain-free days. So even if the amount of rain is the same, the number of days where we have no rain is increasing. And then not so much on average, but from year to year, we have a higher frequency of high wind years. So when we have high wind, this is when we can actually make what would be, you know, a significant fire into a very large fire. So things like the Okanagan Complex in Washington State right now. So we've looked at that, for example, over the last 35 years, and that's what we see for the West. And this is part of what's driving the growing severity of these fire seasons. Also, as we look forward in time, the chances of this continuing are very high, where we're going to see a lot of increases in the temperature. Greater than 70% of summers are expected to be exceeding the highest temperatures on record for the Western U.S. by mid-century, for example, if we continue with our current emissions path. One of the biggest problems for the West, though, is the snow accumulation, which is very important in the montane regions. And they've been getting warmer and will continue to be warmer, so much more of the precipitation will be as rain instead of snow. So greater than 80% of years are expected to have March snow amounts that are less than what would be median values today. And greater than 60% would have March snow amounts that are below the minimum late 20th century amount, so very, very dry. So this will lead to very dry summers in general. And the high temperatures of the summers are likely to be much higher, potentially up to 5 degrees C higher by the end of the century. So an exacerbation of many things would stress to the trees from these events. So they will have significant die-offs of trees in general from drought. And also this opens up for insects and bug kill as well. So we have a combination of factors that will tend to exacerbate the wildfire situation in the West in coming years.
Great. Thank you so much, Mark. That was really interesting. Next up, we will be hearing from Dr. Park Williams. Park is a bioclimatologist and Lamont Assistant Research Professor at Columbia University. You may have seen his recent study that was out last week on the connections between climate change and the drought in California.
Great. Thank you very much. So this study that we just published in the Geophysical Research Letters looks at California over the last 115 years or so and tries to understand how has the global warming process affected drought in California. And specifically, we are looking at the effect of warming on evaporation. And so we take a simple soil moisture modeling approach where we consider precipitation as the inputs of moisture into soil. and then evaporation as the outputs. And in the figure I'm showing, you can see that we consider many different versions of climate data sets. For precipitation, we use four different versions. And then to calculate the evaporation, which is a function of the atmosphere's moisture demand or the potential evapotranspiration, we use temperature data and humidity data and wind speed data and net radiation data. And we use several different versions of data sets for each of those variables. And so the figure on the right that I'm showing indicates all 108 combinations of these variables that we use to calculate the potential evapotranspiration of the atmosphere. And you can see that there's a lot of variability, and you can see that potential evapotranspiration has been increasing. It's increased by about 100 millimeters over the last 115 years. That means that now, in an average year, we'd need about 100 extra millimeters of precipitation, or about 3.5 inches, in order to make up for this increase. We use these variables together, the precipitation and the potential evapotranspiration, to calculate this variable called the Palmer Drought Severity Index. This is a widely used index that is basically just modeled soil moisture standardized into units that can be understood. Units are basically 2 units equals 1 standard deviation departure from the long-term mean. And you can see, if you're looking at the figure, that generally all the data sets we use agree. And you can see that over the last 3 years, we've been in nearly a record-breaking drought, but not quite a record-breaking drought. That differs from some other studies. Going back to the evaporation side of the moisture equation, now in figures, we have broken out the contribution of temperature to the potential evapotranspiration, or the atmosphere's moisture demand, from the other variables being humidity, wind speed, and radiation. And the simple point here is that the reason why the atmosphere's moisture demand has gone up is purely because of temperature. The other variables have not caused an increase over the last century, but temperature has. And so the temperature is the reason why we would need 3.5 extra inches of precipitation to overcome this growing deficit caused by increased potential evapotranspiration. And so we can see what effect that has had now in this figure, where I show the Palmer Drought Severity Index again in orange. This is the observed Palmer Drought Severity Index. And then blue is that index recalculated where precipitation is the only thing that varies. And so that means if all the other variables were at their long-term means, if temperature wasn't changing, then the blue time series is what our drought record would look like. And so you see that they look pretty darn similar, but over time there's been this increasing water deficit, or increasing trend toward drought, and that is because of warming. And so now we look at that in a little more detail. First, we just, in the bar plots I'm showing now, we see that the current drought, or the drought of the 3 year drought from 2012 through 2014, was mainly caused by lack of precipitation. Lack of precipitation accounts for about 70% of the drought severity during those 3 years. The extra 30% is due to increased atmospheric moisture demand. And now we break that out further into the temperature component versus the non-temperature component. We see that the vast majority of the anomaly in high atmospheric moisture demand was caused by warm temperatures, and then a little bit was caused by low humidity and high wind speeds as well. And so now we look at a record of temperature over the last 115 years. We can see that warming has been substantial. Warming is, or temperatures have warmed by about 2.4 degrees Fahrenheit. But it's a bit tough to really figure out how exactly we should try and define the human-caused trend within this temperature record. We take 4 different approaches that we think kind of capture the full range, the full spectrum, ranging from a linear trend, which is pretty conservative because warming has increased pretty rapidly over the last several decades, probably because of increased greenhouse forcing, and then other approaches that involve the IPCC climate models. I won't go into them right now. But we can then redo all of our moisture modeling or soil moisture calculations, where we only allow these trends to occur as opposed to the interannual temperature variation. And in doing that, we can parse out the temperature contribution of this drought into the anthropogenic warming trend, the human-induced warming trend. And we find that depending on the different data sets we use and the various definitions we assign to the anthropogenic warming trend, we find that anywhere between 7 and 28% of the three-year drought during 2012 to 2014 can be attributed to global warming. Put it another way, if global warming had not happened, the drought would still be going on, but it would be somewhere between 7 and 28% less severe. And that number is probably more in the 15 to 20% range. The two outside warming scenarios we consider are pretty extreme. So finally, I wrap up by showing again the record of the Palmer Drought Severity Index. And then overlaid on top of that is the trend caused by warming. And what this slide is meant to show is that interannual natural climate variability is really the driver of drought or wet period in California. But there is this underlying trend towards warming that is having a really important influence, and that trend is only going in one direction. Right now, that trend accounts for somewhere between 0.3 and 0.7 PDSI units. That is actually substantial. The drought would be substantially less severe, probably somewhere between 15 and 20% if that warming trend wasn't there. And as an example of the importance, I finished just by showing two maps. The map on the left is a map showing where drought was record severe during these 3 years in the very dark red. And then the map on the right shows where the drought would be record severe in the absence of the global warming trend. You can see that the drought would still be occurring. It would still be bad, and it would still be record bad in some places. But warming has increased the area that has experienced record-breaking drought by about 45%. And this is, of course, very important to fire. Fire seems to respond exponentially to drought, meaning that incremental intensifications of drought lead to incrementally growing responses to wildfire. There's an exponential response. So when it's already warm and dry, any extra bit of warming is going to have surprisingly large consequences for wildfire. And that's all I have to show.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Park. I will also remind you all that if you'd like a copy of the slides that Park just showed, go ahead and send an email to that info@climatenexus.org address, and we will work to get those over to you. Thank you. And now I would like to introduce Captain Lou Paulson. He's the president of the California Professional Firefighters.
Okay, thank you, Paige. And it's an honor for me to be on this panel with Mark and Park. Let me just give you a real quick background on the California Professional Firefighters. We are the state affiliate of the International Association of Firefighters. We have 30 members represented by 177 affiliated locals. We protect about 36 million Californians every day. And we are actively involved, obviously, in firefighting up and down the state. I don't need to tell you folks that, you know, the state's on fire, the West is on fire, and I think let me just put it into perspective from a emergency response view and how we are looking at this in California. And to the credit of Governor Schwarzenegger, he established Blue Ribbon Fire Commission to look at the problems when we had the fires, big fires in San Diego a number of years ago. And Governor Brown is continuing that with the climate change task force, and we're tackling these issues, realizing that they are not situational to a drought, but more of a trend of the future. And because of that, I think from the fire service perspective, we are changing how we look at wildland firefighting. It's now not uncommon. And in fact, I would tell you, every firefighter in the state of California, whether you're working on an engine company in downtown San Francisco or Los Angeles, or you're working in the foothills of California or in the hills of California, everybody's being trained on how to be a wildland firefighter and what those hazards are, because we do know that these events are not around just the jurisdiction where they happen, that the resources that are needed are going to be a multi-level government. It's very common now to have local government strike teams and firefighters on U.S. Forest National Park property fighting wildland fires, because we do not have the resources. Government does not have the resources at any level to really head this climate change, this wildland fire problem off. And so it's going to take a combined effort. What that ultimately means for various levels of government is that local government becomes more and more stressed, because the fact that while you're sending extra units out to maybe 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 hours from where the jurisdiction is, emergencies are still happening. And it's unfortunately not uncommon that you may send the 5 engine companies out of your own department to a fire in Northern California at the same time you have a wildland fire breakout in your own jurisdiction. So we're seeing more stress and strain on the emergency response system, mutual aid system in California, which is undoubtedly is the best mutual aid system in the world, is having a lot of problems trying to fill capacity and get resources. And as you've seen in an example in Washington, they're asking for firefighters outside the United States to come in. We've had firefighters outside California come into fires already this year, and normally the peak wildland season for California starts in September and runs through early November, although recently that's even become longer and more year-round. So I think from our perspective, we are seeing just more of a fire problem, more of a erratic fire problem. In simple terms, to give you some perspective, when we talk about the high winds that happen, those high winds problem it creates is that it preheats fuel and increases fire spread. So you have spotting in front of the main body of the fire. Those fire conditions become more erratic because conifers and heavier fuels are usually, in a non-drought situation, are more able to sustain a fire. When they're weakened by drought, they become part of the fuel complex and part of the fuel problem. So we as firefighters see the fuel problem expanding exponentially and becoming more and more of a year-round problem than a seasonal problem. So that's a perspective, at least from the firefighters' outlook on climate change.
Thank you so much, Captain Lou. That was really interesting and a new perspective for us here. Okay, now we are going to open up the question and answer portion of the call. We've had a few questions come in. Okay, on that note, I'm going to go ahead and read our first question. It's from Jess Burns. She asks, is there similar drought climate modeling for Oregon and Washington?
This is Park. I guess I'll start. Yes, there is, but not exactly what I've done. The study that we just published is specifically about California. And so, as you can see, perhaps from the maps at the very end, these calculations were done at a very high spatial resolution. And that is why we only did it for California, because they're fairly computationally expensive. But they can be done for other states, and I'm beginning to do that. But probably more importantly, the calculations that I am making are not necessarily all that unique. What's unique in what we have done is the parsing out of the temperature trend component of drought from the natural climate variability component. That had not been done before, but there are data sets out there that show drought records for Oregon and Washington, and they're fairly easy to find.
Thank you so much. Do any of the other speakers want to respond?
I could just say that a couple of weeks ago, we had a paper out in Nature Communications looking at fire danger globally. So it does encompass Washington, Oregon, and there, at least, we're not including the most recent year. So we can see over in east, western Washington, Oregon, that we don't see the same trend in temperature or relative humidity, but they are seeing an increase in the winds. So we're not seeing a lot of the long-term trend indicators there. So this current drought may not be a harbinger of everything that's coming, or at least so far.
Great. And actually, that ties well to Jess Burns had a follow-up question I'm just going to go ahead and read too. Can the increase in wind be connected to climate change, and specifically anthropogenic or human-caused climate change?
Well, can it be linked? Yes. But any particular wind or windy day, no. So what we see are some areas that have more wind, but more of what we see across the globe are a lot of areas that are subject to higher wind periods. So we basically are putting more energy into the atmosphere as we increase temperature and we evaporate things. But then when we have storms, we also release more energy. So, yeah, some of that higher wind can be attributed to global warming.
Thank you so much. So we have a couple of additional questions that have come in. I'm going to take one more from this Q&A right now and then switch to the info inbox. Sherry asks Lou, she wants to know, are there new technologies helping the firefight?
Are there new technologies? Yes. However, at the end of the day, we can put more aircraft up. We can do a lot of things with new technologies. At the end of the day, we need people at the end of a hose line to make sure that the lines that are being hardened by weather, put down by aircraft, can be hardened by hand. So at the end of the day, it still takes people at the end of a shovel or at the end of a hose line to get in and put the hot spots out and clear the area. We're using a lot of technology. One of the things that was implemented last year, and it's a double-edged sword, obviously, because there's concerns, but we did use some drones last year in California to be able to map the progress effectively of the fire overnight while we couldn't fly aircraft so we could get units at first light up and positioned properly to be used effectively. So we're using some technology, some global mapping. For a number of years, California has been on the forefront of predicting economic hazards for fires, especially when they're in intermix, so we can assess resources and prioritize response. And that's been a really useful tool as we try to prioritize when we have multiple fires and limited resources going throughout the state.
Thank you. We have quite a few questions coming in, so I'm going to go ahead and move to the next one. It's from Camille at ClimateWire. She says, she'd like to know more about what we don't know yet about this link between climate and wildfires. Which areas of research are most urgent, and who is doing the most cutting-edge research right now?
I can start by speaking about some things I've been thinking about recently, although I may not be the ultimate authority on this, but one thing that makes wildfire research extremely difficult, I think, is the inability to do controlled experiments out in nature, or at least the extreme difficulty with doing them. The controlled experiments that do occur are done on very small scales. When it comes to large wildfires, really you can only look back in time and try and tease apart what was the cause. And there are so many things going on at once that you're never going to get two fires where there's only one difference, and then you can really isolate the effect of that difference. And so one thing that is, I'd say, cutting edge research or an area that needs to be improved greatly is our understanding of how fuel density and connectivity interact with climate. There has been some work on this, but we definitely see these really strong correlations with, say, area burned in a region and drought. But then the nature of that correlation, say the slope of the regression line between drought severity and area burned, is going to be very affected by the nature of the fuels, how much fuel there is, and how connected it is. As far as I can tell, that is something that quite a few folks have been working on, but I haven't seen anybody really crack the code yet. And related to all that, another thing that I heard earlier was interesting, or at least it sounded like, I believe Lou was noting that perhaps the moisture content of live fuels matters to fire. And the research on that is really debatable, even though it makes good logical sense that as you dry out a live tree, then it may become more flammable. It's hard to actually see that effect in nature, even though we can see it in controlled laboratory studies. And so more work needs to be done on understanding the effect of live fuel moisture on, say, rate of fire spread.
Yeah, I'd like to follow that up. This is Mark Cochran. So partially with regard to that, yeah, we're looking at a lot of the spatial connectivity of fuels and how things burn. Part of that is globally, everything's different. Some places, humans have chopped up a landscape. So especially if you try to work at large scales, you by definition end up using remote sensing. So you need the proper tools to look at the proper scale. You have to deal with time and such. And when you get into whether or not we're going to change how things burn, especially when we deal with live fuel moisture, then you really have to have good data on wind, because wind is one of the prime determinants of whether or not you're going to transition from a surface fire to a crown fire. So yeah, we need all those elements. The thing I was going to follow up with for where the issues are, as I see it, at least as we go forward, is we are changing fire regimes. Everything out there, all the vegetation is actually designed to live within a certain type of fire regime. So within this climate, certain vegetation grows, but that vegetation is designed to burn in a certain way at a certain frequency. And what we are changing now is how often things burn or how intensely, how severely they're going to burn when they burn. So there is an increasing question of whether or not after these fires, are we going to return to the same type of system we had prior to these fires? Now, if the climate were stable, the answer would be yes, but the climate is continually shifting. And at this point, we don't know when we are tipping some of these areas beyond their point of return or what they will be changing to over time.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. We are listening to a teleconference on the Western wildfires hosted by Climate Nexus, recorded August 26, 2015.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Okay. Next up, we have a question for Captain Paulson. The question is from Gloria Dickey. She asks, what changes do you think need to be made to reform wildfire spending and resources?
Well, it's a multi-level issue.
Lou Paulson speaking.
I'm sorry. It's a multi-level issue, and actually the Blue Ribbon Fire Commission in California took a look at this. There are building and code changes that need to happen at the state, at local, national level to put more defensible spaces into the intermix. There is a more commitment to resources, and I think probably the most telling argument to this is U.S. Forces budget is changing from a Department of Agriculture Forest department to more of a firefighting department because of all these fires going on. So I think there's got to be a refocus by legislators and policymakers to say this issue is not going away. We need to fund it properly. And fire in the wildland has always been around. The severity of it now is just dramatic. And unless we're able to commit resources early as these fires start, and have better forest management, as an example, we're going to have a lot more loss going forward. And it's of two sides of the coin. I think we've got the summertime fire season, but flipping the coin over on the other side, with less snowpack, we'll have more rain, and potentially more rain and more runoff, more flooding, more problems with the groundwater supply, reservoirs filling up with silt. It creates kind of a cycle that is not good. Not a sustainable cycle for the West.
Terrific. Thank you, Lou. And actually, I have another question from you. It's also from Gloria. She asks a follow-up to Sherry's earlier question about technology. She wants to know, what about earlier detection technology, such as HD cameras? She notes that there's a project going on in Eastern California that crowd spotters get to the fires earlier.
Yeah, it's Lou Paulson again. Yeah, we have used some technology. We've used some lightning detection technology. Again, there's not one answer that's going to deal with this problem, because it depends on where the fires are occurring. If it's low in the intermix or if it's high in the forest, and the ability to reach those complexes, those fires quickly. We are deploying some ignition technology to try to detect things as they happen. But not all fires in the West are caused by lightning, as an example. So you've got some of them are man-made, and those are difficult to track based on, again, where they happen. And, you know, whether it's a campfire or a car accident or something, that's going to create a different variable. So there's not one piece of technology that's going to do anything or be one size fits all, so to speak. But we're looking at all those things. The state of California has been testing quite a few of those different ideas. And actually, we've also gone back to lookouts, to actually physical people out doing lookouts instead of the technology that's out there, because sometimes it's more reliable in technology. So I think we're in this flux of technology and how we apply it to this situation. I think there's not a clear path yet, because people are trying various avenues to try to get things done.
If I could follow up, Mark Cochran, I'd like to point out, though, that we cannot, even if we had all the technology, put every right. fire out and keep things from burning. These are landscapes that are designed to burn, and the longer we keep fire out, the worse the situation becomes, until we get to where we are now in some of those areas where we've just created a larger problem over time due to our previous success. So we were successful from 1910 on for quite a while, and now we are reaping the whirlwind, so to speak, from some of those successes, not in every system, but in some areas.
And this is Lou Paulson again. If I could just chime in on that. And again, the wildland fire problem is a broad problem, and depends on how you view that complex, that situation, whether it's in a forest fire situation or whether it's in a grass chaparral mix situation. Those fire behaviors are going to be somewhat similar, but also different. And so folks unfortunately get locked into a lot of the pictures on the news where they're seeing forests burn down, but also we've got situations where we've got light flashy fuels, grass, chaparral, etc. Fire spread will be very quick, and our ability to respond to those, potentially are hampered based on the ability to get to them. So we can't put you're absolutely right. We can't put all the fires out. There's a lot of issues on forest management in the past that have created some of this problem, but there's not necessarily one size fits all. And I think that's what makes part of this, from the, at least from the emergency response perspective, so challenging.
Thank you. Our next question is scientific in nature, and it's from Sherry Swinsick at Weather 8, at 8 News Now in Las Vegas. She asks, any reason why that you would think of for why Washington State is having such a bad year for fires? And she also asks, will the poor air quality have any long-lasting effects over wildfire areas like Idaho right now and the Pacific Northwest?
Well, I can take a stab at that. Mark Cochran. The main reason why Washington is burning right now is because of this incredible drought that has been going on there. So you've had a lot of fuel buildup over the years. You had severe fires even last year in some of it, but nothing quite like this year. With extensive drought, once things are burning, they're basically able to spread further and further. Unless we get a good rain, a lot of those fires will not go out. Firefighters will protect some areas, but they will not likely be able to actually put out these huge complexes of fires. As for the impacts, thankfully, once the smoke clears, people's lungs will start to clear. And in that regard, the impact should start tapering off once the air clears. In terms of longer term effects, not so much. It'll move around a certain amount of nutrients and things and change some ecological factors, but nothing substantial that I can think of here.
This is Luke Paulson. If I can just add on the smoke exposure side to give you the firefighter's perspective, this is something that smoke exposure itself has always been an issue of concern for the fire service, and in wildland, it's even more based on we really have no technology to give long-term protection to firefighters in the field. But it's not uncommon for firefighters out in a fire to be exposed to high levels of carbon monoxide for days on end. We've had fires in the past where we actually had to bring in oxygen for the first responders because we couldn't get the CO levels out of their blood, because they've been working at such a high level of carbon monoxide for such a long period of time. So the issue of smoke from the wildland, smoke overall, is something that the fire service is tackling with and trying to figure out how we can deal with it.
Thank you. Unless you have something to add, Park, I'm going to go ahead and we have another question. This one from Emily Gertz. It's for Captain Paulson. She asks, could you please describe some of the shortfalls in manpower and equipment that firefighters have experienced this year? How much would staffing and equipment need to increase to handle the increase in wildfires?
This is Luke Paulson again. We do not have that data right now. I will tell you by the fall we'll have the data to be able to determine that. I couldn't give you a number. I sit on a group called FireScope, and we meet quarterly, and it's all the agencies, all the government agencies that deal with wildland and all risk response. I'll tell you anecdotally, we are having, because the mutual aid system in the state of California is all voluntary, we're having less departments put units up for response because they have less resources. Part of that is budgetary restraints based on the recession. And because of that, they've got less ability to hire. And part of that is the commitment that some of these strike teams are doing, where they're doing 14 to 21 days with no relief. But we don't have any hard numbers right now.
Terrific. Thank you so much. I have one more question that just came in for Park Williams. They ask, given that the California drought is now going into its fourth year, but we are expecting this to be a strong El Nino year, how optimistic are you that we could see some drought relief in the coming year?
Okay. Yeah, this is Park. And I'd say that I am cautiously optimistic. You'll see if you look into it that over the last two or three years, California has fallen about 1 year behind in terms of precipitation deficit. That makes it sound like it would be really hard to end this drought. It makes it sound like we'd basically need twice as much precipitation this year as an average year in order to end the drought. But I'd say that's probably not necessarily true. Really, in order to end the drought from the perspective that we're talking about now, we need to fill the soils back up. And that doesn't necessarily take a doubling of precipitation. And so I am somewhat optimistic that this winter could be the end. I'm more optimistic that in the next few years, the drought will certainly end. As I said earlier, natural climate variability dominates still in California. And in California, natural climate variability is particularly strong. but it's not necessarily going to hinge on El Nino. You know, in the Sierra Nevadas, where many of the wildfires occur, or up in the northern coast range, El Nino is not a very strong predictor, actually, of how much precipitation falls. It accounts for something like 7% of the variability, meaning that there are other processes not related to El Nino necessarily that do it. However, in years like this, when El Nino is very strong, there is a tendency for precipitation to be higher than average. But exactly how much higher than average is really anybody's guess, as far as I can tell. And so I would say that drought conditions will improve probably in California this year. They may not get all the way back to neutral or above average this year, but the next 3 years, I can almost guarantee that California will once again be wet.
Great, thank you. We have one final question that's come in. Sorry, I know I keep saying that, but we'll wrap after this question. This question is from Jess Burns again. She asks, is there any prediction of how long the effect of decades of forest suppression will take to burn itself out? Any projections of what wildfire seasons will look like once the excessive fuel is gone? And will climate change become the primary indicator of fire severity?
Okay, this is Mark. I don't know. That's quite a lot of questioning there. In order for like all the years of fire suppression to so-called burn themselves out would require quite a lot of burning. First of all, just to cover the amount of area that you'd say should have burned. But then even so, it doesn't just end there because we have to reestablish the undo all these years of fire suppression, assuming we were to try to do that, and we're not necessarily doing that yet, would take decades to a century or more, just because it's not just we'd have to burn a lot of area because we've kind of missed a lot of fire cycles in places. But even once you do that, you have to reestablish the forest structure that was there previously. So that will take quite a long time, and in some places even longer, like over in the Pacific Northwest, over in the like the Oregon coast and such, some of those areas would take hundreds of years to really reestablish what was there previously, if that's what we were trying to do. So in that regard, it would be a long process. The problem we have now, though, is as climate changes, we don't even know what it is we would be trying to get back to. With people on this landscape, it's a very different process in the end, though. We have to somehow manage a process where we can live in the areas and still try to establish a reasonable ecosystem on the remaining lands that incorporates fire.
This is Park, and I'd just like to add one very small thing, and that is, you know, even if we were to begin letting all fires burn, which would, of course, never happen because there are some areas that we just can't allow to do so, where people live, for example, the fires are seeming to burn much differently than they did in a totally natural context. They're much more energetic, and so we're seeing these mega fires now that rather than doing the what we can think of as the healthy thing, the forests where they can promote regeneration and keep forests in some kind of equilibrium, they destroy forests entirely. And so what comes back after these mega fires may not be anything close to what we might consider to be the natural state of the forests. And so this concept of, or this idea of whether or not we should allow fires to burn or not, or whether, you know, how exactly to go about fixing this century-long problem in the making, is extremely, extremely complicated.
Thank you so much. That was a fascinating discussion. I lied before. We had one final question. Our final question is from Sherry, again, at 8 News Now. And I just like this question because I think it wraps up the call pretty well. She asks, has the lack of available water in reservoirs hindered fighting California's wildfires this year?
This is Lou. I would say, has it affected strategy and tactics to a certain extent? Yes. But because of that, from a response capability, we're sending out more water tenders to some of the on-strike teams than we ever have before. The kind of the concept of bringing your water along, which again, is a strategy and tactics issue. But I would say it's hampered, but it hasn't hindered, if that's kind of splitting hairs. It's made it a little more difficult, and where we would see, especially in the upper elevations where we see year-round lakes and streams, potentially, we know that they're not there now, and so we're going to adjust our tactics and strategy based on that. And if I could just go back for one quick second to the previous discussion, I think we don't want to lose sight of we can talk about all the science, but there's also public policy that's going to drive the results here. And as many folks are aware, science and public policy sometimes don't always agree. So I think there's big public policy debates on this issue that have got to be had, and people in government have got to come to a realization of how this is, I hate to say it, the new normal going forward.
I'm going to go ahead and wrap this call up. Thank you to all three of our panelists. You were excellent, and it was very enlightening to hear your responses and thoughts on the wildfires today. If you have any follow-up questions, please feel free to email us at info@climatenexus.org.
You've been listening to a teleconference on the climate drivers of the humongous wildfires burning in Western North America. It was hosted by Climate Nexus at climatenexus.org. Find links to all the speakers and more information in my weekly Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. That's published every Wednesday. All of our speakers kept referring to the drought, which in California is in its fourth year. It's even gone up the West Coast, where it should be wet. That cost billions in agricultural production in California and left the landscape ready for wildfires in the hot summer. But it looks like we're in for much worse in the future as climate change unrolls.
Radio EcoShock.
You think it's dry in the American West this year? You ain't seen nothing yet, according to a new study published in the journal Advances in Science. The title is Unprecedented 21st Century Drought Risk in the American Southwest and Central Plains. I've reached the lead author, Dr. Benjamin Cook, from the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Dr. Cook, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
What kind of a drought are we talking about? What would it look like?
What we're really looking like for the future is kind of a progressive drying, kind of a shift in the kind of background, you know, what we might consider normal conditions towards a much drier mean state. And so within this shift towards much drier background conditions, we're still going to get the kind of year-to-year variations that we see right now in the West, periods of wet and periods of dry. But what we're going to see is that these droughts, when they do occur, are going to be that much drier because they're happening in a much drier baseline. And this is going to make it much, much easier for us to get droughts that are 20, 30, perhaps even 40 years long, events that are really unprecedented in terms of what we're used to over the last 200 years.
For our international listeners, the dry American Southwest is well known, but where exactly do you mean by the Central Plains?
By the Central Plains, we're talking about Texas, up through Nebraska, Oklahoma, kind of the center of the country that's also a really important agricultural region for the United States.
Does that include the wheat growing area?
Yes, wheat, corn, and also grazing of livestock.
Okay, so there are previous models of mega droughts happening before humans loaded the atmosphere with carbon. Where does human-induced global warming fit into this scheme?
So during the what we call the medieval era, basically the 1100s and 1200s, you know, we know from tree ring records that there were these really extended mega droughts that occurred in the Southwest and in the Central Plains. And those were obviously driven by just natural variations in the circulation of the ocean and the atmosphere. In the future, what we're seeing is kind of a different mechanism operating. You know, what's happening is because we're loading the atmosphere with CO2, we're leading to warmer conditions. And these warm conditions increase evaporation. And what this increased evaporation does is, independent of anything that changes with rainfall or snowfall patterns, the surface is just going to get that much drier because the atmosphere just wants that much more moisture. You know, a good way to kind of think about it is in your front yard, a puddle. You know, and if that puddle is there in July when it's really, really warm, then it's not going to last very long and it might be gone by the end of the day, versus a puddle of the same size there maybe in fall or winter when things are much, much cooler, and so that puddle has a good chance to last a lot longer.
But we do need to remember that a hotter world is a wetter world. Why does this part of North American continent get even less rain in the future while others might get more?
Well, it's, you know, when we add CO2 to the atmosphere and when we warm up the atmosphere, we basically supercharge the hydrologic cycle. And what that means is that the dry areas and the dry times get drier, and the wet areas and the wet times get wetter. So in this warmer world, we expect areas that are already dry, like the Central Plains, the Southwest, Southern Africa, Australia, are going to get even drier, whereas places that have a lot of moisture, like parts of Canada, parts of northern Europe, you know, those wetter places are going to get that much wetter.
I have read books about the drying of the West, and we've seen previous papers predicting decadal droughts. What is new about the study that you led?
You know, the real kind of new finding in our study was our attempt to place the future climate change projections, what we think is going to happen towards the end of the 21st century, within the context of the full spectrum of variability over the last 1,000 years. You know, we wanted to ask the question, well, you know, how will future droughts compare to even the worst natural droughts of the last 1,000 years, those mega droughts that occurred during the 1100s and the 1200s? And our conclusion from this is, you know, no matter how you kind of look at the models, no matter how you analyze them, you basically get the same answer, which is that these future droughts are very likely to be longer and more intense than even the driest centuries of the last millennium.
And I also recall reading that the European period of settlement in Australia just happened to coincide with the long period of wetter weather that may have allowed agriculture that may be over. Is that also true of North America?
Well, it's a little bit complicated because at various points during the 19th century, there were explorers out west who variably either described the western United States as a great desert or a great garden. You know, and what that really reflects is the kind of substantial variability that we see in this region. We see wet periods and we see very substantial, significant dry periods in western North America. But what we're going to see in the future is kind of a shift towards more of those dry periods and less of those wet periods.
In California, as you know, we're seeing many acres of formerly productive cropland and even nut orchards now abandoned for lack of water. What do you think a mega drought means for the American and even the world food supply?
You know, that's a really tough question because we have lots of infrastructure and lots of ways to deal with droughts. We can pump groundwater, we can build surface reservoirs to accumulate moisture during the wet periods and then use it during the dry periods, and we have various techniques for conserving water. So there's actually still a lot of water in places like the West and California, even during droughts. The trick is going to be learning how to use it a little bit more smartly, all right? Particularly in the American West, our water allotments and our water usage is based on the assumption that there's a lot more water than is actually available. And so there's no real incentive to conserve, and, you know, people just use whatever they can. But I think with a little bit more smart management and a little more careful consideration of how we use water and what we use it for, we can still have a, you know, productive agricultural system in many of these places.
I think one of the examples that many people bring up are the American Indians who had to leave the Arizona region because of a big drought hundreds of years ago. Are you predicting something so serious that we may have to abandon some major cities like Las Vegas or Phoenix? Or, as you've just said, do you think we'll be able to adapt to drought that lasts 20 or 30 years?
I think we can adapt. But again, it's going to require some actual proactive management and policy making, because we're not going to have the same amount of water in the future to do the things that we're doing now, right? And, you know, we're obviously starting to see many of these, the impacts of these droughts on tourism and agriculture and municipal areas. So we're starting to get a taste of the kind of water availability that we're going to have in the future. And in some ways, it's actually maybe a good thing because it kind of highlights the need to start to rethink about how we use this water and try to build a more resilient future, which, you know, again, I think is still in the cards as long as we're kind of paying attention to what nature is doing.
Ben Cook, how certain are you of this prediction? Is it possible we could go through the second decade of this century without experiencing a mega drought?
Oh, certainly. I mean, there's always uncertainties in these projections. So one of the biggest uncertainties is the models that we analyzed, you know, make an assumption that we're going to continue on our current trajectory of greenhouse gas emissions and warming. Certainly, if we choose a different trajectory, perhaps one where we have less greenhouse gas emissions than we expect, you know, the drying to be less severe. You know, there's always uncertainties in our understanding of how these different regions respond to climate change. But I will say that overall, the evidence is firmly pointing towards a shift towards these drier conditions in the American West if we continue greenhouse gas emissions on the current trajectory.
Your paper says, quote, North American drought variability during the historical period is driven primarily by ocean atmosphere teleconnections. That got me wondering, what does that mean? Could you describe that for us?
Sure. So there are lots of natural droughts in the West. you know, some of the most well-understood and known ones are the Dust Bowl in the 1930s or the 1950s drought in the Southern Plains. And these droughts were forced primarily by basically modes of ocean circulation that changed the circulation of the atmosphere over North America and kind of shifted storms away and started these drought conditions rolling during those time periods. And so one of the biggest drivers of drought in the West is the El Niño Southern Oscillation, particularly the cold phase of that pattern where we get a La Niña event that shifts storm tracks further north, and that lead to dry conditions in Southern California, the Southwest, and the Southern Plains. This coming year, we're probably going to see a very strong El Niño event, a warm phase of that phenomenon, and that actually has the opposite effect, and we'll be hopefully steering more storms into the Southwest, the Central Plains, and Mexico, and hopefully providing some drought relief in those areas.
Ben, you're talking about something that nobody alive has ever seen, and I'm sort of afraid this study will stimulate a few news stories and then be added to that list of unstoppable climate horrors we can't do anything about. How do you see the future of this work now?
I guess I'm hoping that people see it as motivation for some proactive management and development. You know, we're pretty smart as a species, and, you know, I think there's lots of opportunities in our water systems to improve efficiency, to find better uses for water, to maybe exploit resources that haven't really been exploited yet. And that's all stuff that's going to have to happen. You know, the future is not written in stone, or these projections do not mean a kind of apocalypse and a wholesale abandonment of the West. But what it does mean is that there's very likely going to be less water for people and ecosystems in these regions. And we can either kind of be proactive about it and try to figure out ways to deal with it or even avoid the problem, or we can wait till it actually happens and then try to clean up things after disaster strikes. I hope we don't choose the latter.
From the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies and also the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory of Columbia University, we've been talking with scientist Benjamin I. Cook. He's the lead author of a new study, ominously, I think, titled Unprecedented 21st Century Drought Risk in the American Southwest and Central Plains. Benjamin, thank you so much for sharing your time with Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Find links for this discussion, including the full text of this paper, in my weekly show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. I don't know about you, but I'm really doubtful our civilization can adapt to 30 or 40-year droughts. Just consider the impact on agriculture. The Southwest and the Central Plains feed not only America, but the world. We're talking beef, corn, wheat, and much more. I don't think most farmers there will survive, and I predict major cities in the area will shrink even more than Detroit just did. That's just my opinion, and it's based on the scientists and the authors I've interviewed. Next week, we'll have a review of the huge climate news that's poured out all summer. It's building like a drumbeat before the Paris talks this coming December. I don't hold a lot of hope that essential changes will be made there, but we do have to try. Anyway, whether politicians and corporate CEOs listen or not, thousands of scientists and activists around the world are ringing that bell of warning as loud as we can. Our opening music came courtesy of Dana Pearson, also known on SoundClick as Vast Man. Dana's got a lot of great tunes there you can download for free. From my studio in Smokeville, I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about your world. California, BC's best.